appears real. And I'm a heterosexual woman with a baby. And I just, and the confusion and the fear of being judged. And it's interesting also that it's coming up that that's a feeling about the women's movement. And I'm trying to figure, I'm trying to place that one. So I feel like I'm reiterating things, but I wouldn't mind hearing more about it from all of you. So.
Hold on. We have now have three speakers, so I will try to get the panelists to respond. But if they do it every time, you won't have a chance to speak. So I'm going to take a couple of speakers right now. Sheila, you're first.
I'm in the same child care co-op as the lady who just spoke. I also have a child, heterosexual woman. This is really bringing up so much for me, because I've had a lot of kitchen rages and discussions with women about how come we're not talking about this. I think this is the biggest secret under wraps. And that really became apparent to me after I had a child, because my sexuality really changed, or it certainly seemed to disappear. And here it is 2 years later, and it still seems to have disappeared. And I think, Jesus Christ, you know, because I used to tell my friends, I still tell my friends, but I don't feel quite honest when I do it. I used to say, well, you know, if it's not working in your relationship now, then you have to ask yourself someplace along the line, what would you say to your son or daughter if that were happening to them in their relationship? Would you say, well, you put your sexuality in a box and you leave it in the closet for the rest of your life because you can't deal with it within your feminist ideology, you can't deal with it, the conflict is so great between what your desires are and what you think you believe. And I found myself in relationships when I think, oh, because I have been involved with men, mostly, then I find myself thinking, well, this guy is struggling as much as I'm struggling, and he's pretty decent. By and large, he's the best of the bad lot. I think I'm pretty lucky to have the one I got, right? That's the truth. And then I think, well, how come the desire is not there? Because all this other stuff is there. I wish it were there. How am I going to get it there? And what if it ain't going to be there? And then I have to deal with telling my kid, well, I add me to the stacks, to the stats, I'm going to be, you know, this is going to be a split-up situation, da, 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 da. And then there's the realization between the man and I, the father of this child, that how we live and how our sexuality is affecting how his will be. And we know it all the time, even in just touching him, rolling around on the floor with him, whatever we're doing with him, we're thinking, you know, he's recently discovered the word bum. He's fascinated. He wants us to pat his bum endlessly. And you think, what will this mean? it is real obvious. And this conflict is just outrageous. And I came to this conference because the other thing I want to say. Yeah, really, my friend bailed me out. She said, Shula, you've got to stop going to school for a weekend and do something fun. So I find on Tuesdays, I think the problem is mine. Right. On Thursdays, I think it's the culture. And it sort of goes like that all the time. I find a pervasiveness of corporate values in a personal life. Like, it sometimes seems to me like if you have enough money, you can buy time to explore the realms of pleasure. And if you don't, you can't. And you work, my God. It seems like it's just this, and then it's this, and then it's that, and it's this cause, and that cause, and it's getting the groceries, and da-da-da-da. And sex. I like sex at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Almost never am I free at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So this is that, you know, those whole things really dominate the real life. And sex, I think, well, is it in the closet for the next 30 years? I refuse. And then I know it'll break out somewhere down the line, you know. The passion will go, wow, and I'll jump, I'll jump onto somebody totally inappropriate. Shit. Thank you. I live in fear of desire and in fear of fear. That's it.
I have another topic. Briefly, I should just explain. For 10 years, I worked with the former film censor here to change the censorship laws. We now have film classification with nonprofit film. I've been associated for a long time. So that now we have classification instead of straight censorship, and we also have the ability of a private club to show films without censorship. They can bring in so-called censorable material. But I have been disturbed by a couple of things I've heard, not disturbed, but a couple of people have said things here about there is no right and wrong, there is no that. I think if you choose to live in a society, and we all have to, we do choose certain standards of right and wrong. What we do in our private life is up to us. But what we do, I don't mean in public, but I mean the certain standards we accept. I'm wondering what the panel feels. Do they feel there is a dividing line between what is right and wrong? For me, pornography, and I've seen quite a bit of pornography, usually involves abuse. For me, wrong is when anybody, any animal, any child, any man, woman, is abused, is put into a situation where they are sexually, physically, mentally, and in the workplace, abused. For me, it is right if you do it of your free will. How we come to this free will is something that has been discussed here. Is it because we are formed by society? Do we know it is our own free will? But for me, this has been raised a couple of times. People have said there is no such thing as right and wrong. We've got to do this. Surely we all have to accept certain things as being right and wrong, or we couldn't live within our society as it is now. We may wish to change that society, but we have to do it in various ways. I don't want to see us go back through this business of everybody is allowed to do what he wishes to the situation where you had in the Regency, where you had little bond servants at 9 who were sold to a man to be raped, then were taken back, sewn up, and this could happen to them for 20, 30 times. And this was called the privilege. It was rich men who could buy them, but poor men would have bought them too if they'd had the money, but that was accepted at the time as being something you were allowed to do. How do we come to the standard of what we are allowed to do? Is something I would like to hear the panel address.
I'm going to suggest, because we're now past 1:30, that the panelists all respond to this question and then we break for lunch. I know there's probably more discussion that could go on, but we've got another day and a half, and if that's acceptable to everybody, I'll cut it off after this response. Okay.
I think in terms of right and wrong, I think we rephrase that and say that we're talking about issues of power. It's one of the reasons I feel disturbed when women are constantly being put in this category of victims, like all of us across the board. And you can get, you know, special grants from the government for jobs if you're, you know, a cripple or a woman. Or it's constantly putting yourself in this position of powerlessness by very definition. And I think that we all have differing degrees of power, and we have to recognize that and take responsibility for those times when we do have power. I'll just cite a couple of examples. I think one is around the issue of child sexuality and their interaction with adults. I think there's times when, without denying children the right to explore their sexuality, you have to accept that as an adult you may have more power. And particularly if you are that child's teacher or whatever, or maybe the child is a teenager, maybe they're in university. There's times when we all have to recognize our own power and our own potential for abusing other people. And that's one. And I had the other one, I guess, is kind of into the women's movement, where often because we form collectives that get money to have employees, we often don't accept the fact that there is a power relationship between us as employers and those who work for us. I think it's another example where those things get very, very fuzzy. And so I guess the bottom line is accepting responsibility and recognizing what power we may have, even if it isn't the power of the corporations.
By God.
Well, I mean, I think we could probably spend another day talking about that question, at least. But what comes to my mind is that I think, again, going back to the whole thing of making judgments, that when I think that we are in a dilemma where we're trying to decide what is right and wrong before we know what we are. And that always presents some problems. And I think that what women have had difficulty with so far is that the notion that there is a right or wrong about what we're doing has prevented us from telling the truth and then from knowing it. And then we end up sort of in a cycle of silence and lies and dishonesty that we never get out of. So I'm not trying to throw out the idea of right and wrong, but I think that it has really restricted our possibility for knowing anything. And at the same time, I think we still have to be looking at ourselves as members of a community, not just a bunch of individual little robots running around doing what we feel like doing whenever. And I think that a sense of community responsibility is at least sort of a bottom line we can work with in terms of talking to each other. But I think that's also got to be mitigated by a real depth in our own examination of ourselves and how much we take that responsibility and project it onto other people rather than onto ourselves.
I guess I just want to say that I'm not so worried about that issue, frankly speaking, because I feel like I'm more concerned long range with exploring what it is that are the components of sexuality. And I don't think when I'm worried more about whether it's good or it's bad or it's right or it's wrong, I can bring into it the things that I need to bring into it, both myself and from other discussions from other people. That when it's like writing, when you edit yourself before you write, you never write down what you need to write. When you paint a picture that you want done before it's painted, you don't get the picture at the end. I feel like it is not out of the question, especially given the sense of let's not fool ourselves, not like we have the power to enact a feminist morality right now if we all agreed on it, that we more need to backtrack and take a chance someplace else. Like at the beginning of the women's movement, we didn't know where feminism would lead. We didn't know, and we were asked all the time by the male left. I remember being asked almost every hour, what do you want? Well, I wanted the space to find out what I wanted. And it wasn't liberal for me to say that I had never had the space in my life as a woman to explore what that meant to me. And I think sexuality is the same thing. I do not think it's a bourgeois issue. I do not think it's a middle class issue. I do not think it's a white issue. I think it's at the core of how people organize their lives. And as long as that's true, we need to be able to talk about why we do what we do. And if we can't do that, we can't, at the end of that, come out with any clear notion of direction. I mean, that is my agenda. I do want a direction at the end of it. I don't want to swim out there by myself for the rest of my life. But I also don't want to be channeled into somebody else's direction before I understand why the current moves the way it does.
Okay, before you go, two things. First of all, I'd like to thank the panelists for what I think has been a marvelous beginning discussion for this conference, and they've been tremendous in their answers, and it's been very easy to facilitate. So, and thank you also for all your questions.
Can I just address something?
And there are two procedural suggestions coming. Your second, Varda, you had a procedural proposal?
My name is Varda Burston. I've come from Toronto to attend this conference, and I have a problem on a slightly different plane. I'm a chemically sensitive person, which means that I have a very hard time with things like perfumes, cigarette smoke, and everything else. And I'm fading fast, and I really desperately want to be able to be here throughout the weekend. So I have a special request, which is to those of you who are, giving off beautiful essences of fragrances, which everybody else is enjoying. I wonder whether you would be able to tone them down or even perhaps do without them for the next day and a half so that I would be able to sit here and breathe and be able to participate. Thanks.
I just wanted to address quickly something that, Amber? Yeah, I just got in for the last part of your speech, but there's something that you said that really upset me was that you talked about young women, and I've been talking to young women across Canada for the last year and a half, and I don't think that young women aren't talking about abortion, which was something you had suggested, and you also said that you didn't think that young women were picking up the women's movement. And I think that perhaps the question that should be asked is why young women don't feel the women's community is accessible to them.
Absolutely. Real quick. You're right that I do think that that's the second question is the right question. And I also think maybe our situations are different because I'm coming into a situation where my lover teaches women's studies. And the women that come in to take her class are a lot of the women I'm talking to. And they don't think that there's anything there for them, and they're not very interested in abortion. So a lot of where I've been doing speaking is deciding for me where I'm getting that information. And if your situation is different, I'm glad.
Okay, 3 o'clock, reconvene.
And if you're interested in the book, or if you've got material that could be part of the book, she'd love it if you talked to her about that. The third announcement is that there are tickets for the brunch left, and it's only $5. It's tomorrow morning, and if you'd like to come, please talk to the conference organizers or the people at the table, and feel free to buy one. And lastly, a number of women have said that they, coming out of the last session, would really like to have a chance to talk to other women in a women-only context, and we're suggesting that if you'd like to do that, maybe meet up at the front after the panel so that you guys can go out to, you women can go out to dinner together. Okay. My name, by the way, is Sarah Diamond, and the panelists for this session are Joan Borsa, Varda Burston, and Sue Golding, and I will introduce each of them as their presentation comes up. The first person, I'm going to change mics. Sorry for the drama, but I like feedback, but okay. Is this one working? Great. The first person who will give her presentation is Joan Borsa, and she's from Saskatoon. She's an independent curator who is also Prairie Regional Editor of Vanguard Magazine. She's a lecturer at the University of Saskatchewan on art education. Joan.
Could someone shut the lights off when I ask for them to be shut off? So not yet, but. We're trying something different this time. It's instead of the lamp, and I don't know if it's going to work, but yes, okay. Basically, what I want to say before I start my presentation is that my talk is going to be specifically about art issues. Anything that I say hopefully will be placed in a larger context, but all of my ideas come specifically from an art context. There's one thing that I want to mention before I begin, and that is that while I was trying to put this paper together, I realized that often you do a monologue with yourself and you don't have anyone to answer any of your questions or react against things to. So I picked a person, Nell Tanhoff in Montreal, who's an artist and former director of Powerhouse, and we've had this ongoing exchange for the last month through the mail and phone calls. And so I just want to give her credit for being a thinking board. Also, I want to say that I'm not talking about newer media in art. I'm not talking about anything to do with film, video, performance, and or installation, partly because some of those areas will be covered by other people, but also because I'm specifically curious about art medium, older art medium that are seeped in tradition, particularly male-dominated tradition, and the challenge for women in terms of creating new images within those medium. And then the last thing I want to say before I begin is that due to time restrictions, I won't be able to discuss all of the slides in great detail. So excuse me if I don't always mention the artist's name or specifics about the slides. Now, in developing my paper on contemporary sexual imagery by women artists specifically, and attempting to present some overview of women artists' representations of erotica and desire, certain issues continually surfaced. As I looked at images of sexuality by women, as I read articles and reviews on the topic, it became clear that any images on sexuality made by women would enter into the larger arena of art and eroticism, whose entire history has been male-defined and male-dominated. Historically, erotic imagery in art or other forms has not been created by women, nor has it been created for women. Our sexual desire, our sense of pleasure. Women's role in sexual imagery has traditionally been the stimulant, the object of desire. It is only in the most recent past, actually the last 15 years or so, that women artists have been coming out of the closet and producing sexual imagery in more direct and honest ways. Certainly, women artists in the past have dealt with their sexuality, but most often in a rather disguised manner. People like Helen Frankenthaler, Georgia O'Keeffe, Frida Kahlo, Eva Hesse, Louise Nevelson. But often the sexual overtones were abstracted and ambiguous, and many of the artists even denied that there were any sexual innuendos. Without a tradition of their own to refer to, act against, or reassess, contemporary women artists are in the position where first they must acknowledge that they do have sexual desire, then develop a language, a unique language of their own, that will give those feelings form. But this cannot be done by simply increasing the production, the number of sexual images coming into the viewing place. Women's imaging of sexuality is completely locked into their position in culture. This means that the practice of women producing positive or alternative images of their desires, their notions of sexuality, cannot easily be accomplished. In art, images enter into a historically determined context where art, whether it's images of eroticism or otherwise, and particularly when it refers to the female body, already mean something. That is, images are seen in relation to other images, and we have learned within and through art history how to respond and read images. So how do women represent when in art they have always been represented? Can we authentically represent our desires, and I mean authentically, our notions of eroticism, when we have for so long been fed notions of our sexuality by male authors. How Anne Kaplan points out in an article, is the gaze male? Woman is the recipient of male desire, the passive recipient of his gaze. If she is to have sexual pleasure, it can only be constructed around her objectification. It cannot be a pleasure that comes from desire for the other, a subject position, because for her, desire is to be desired. In art, for several centuries now, pleasures of the body, notions of eroticism, have taken two distinct directions, the pleasure of looking and the pleasure of being looked at, a voyeurism for men and an exhibitionism for women. Women have had a great deal of practice with receiving the look, being a spectacle of beauty, being objects of the male gaze. They have had little practice with the pleasure of looking and being subjects of the gaze. As Pollock and Parker mention in Old Mistresses, traditional iconography, and in this case, I refer to the tradition of the female nude, works against women's attempts to represent themselves. In traditional art practice, woman is present as an image, as a body, not as an artist. Man is absent from the image, but it is his speech, his view, his position of dominance, which the images signify. And if someone could put the projector on and the lights out, please. Now, in this first group of slides, four slides, from French, middle to late 19th century, by Gauguin and Courbet. Basically, I'm trying to illustrate the notion of the male gaze, that there is a male spectator, and that woman is a spectacle of beauty. So I just want to quickly show four slides that in some way will establish what my reference point is. This one? All right. Okay, I'm just going to pause there and continue for a moment. Ideologies and representations of woman and man are presented, repeated, and fixed in place. The situation is particularly evident in art. Consider the term old master and its female equivalent. An old mistress has quite a different connotation. Yet the connotation is quite accurate when we consider woman's status in the art world. The term artist implies male. We do not say men artists and women artists, but artists and women artists. Within the art structure, the notion of artist is almost exclusively a male act. Art academies appeared in the late 17th century as places where art education could officially occur, but women were not allowed to study at them. This exclusion from a male-defined art practice created the myth that women made art differently, that their feminine traits, their biology, somehow prevented them from making real art or great art. Again, referring to Pollock and Parker's book, Old Mistresses, the sex of the artist determines the way art is seen. And the way art is seen is based on the intersection of two opposing notions, the concept of the artist as male genius and the stereotype of femininity as inherently incapable of genius. How art has been seen is evident by references surrounding the act of painting. The thrust, force,
rhythm, mastery, push and pull and vigor, language, suggests that painting is done with the erect penis. Van Gogh apparently told a fellow artist, eat well, do your military exercises, and don't fuck too much. And because of not fucking too much, your paintings will be all the more spermatic. The use of the female nude in art goes beyond what is described as sensitivity to anatomy and form. It is based in the pleasure of looking, or as Van Gogh might have said, she was a mechanism. She kept your paintings virile. The pleasure of looking was transferred to the male viewer or owner of the painting. This may be one exploration of eroticism. The difficulty with his example is the one-sidedness of the act. He looked and painted her. She was put on display and in his service. The position of exclusion and status based on the sex of the artist is a crucial factor in 20th century art practice. In both E.A. Gombrich's Story of Art and H.W. Janssen's History of Art, which have served as the basis for most first-year modern art history courses in North America, not one woman artist is mentioned. We now know that there have always been a large number of women artists, but contemporary art history paints a picture where women are absent, and therefore the myth is created that women artists are of lesser talent or lesser historical significance. Woman in art practice has been a backdrop, but a backdrop with soft curves, erect nipples, evocative smiles, and inviting cavities. She became exclusively associated with her biology and her sex rather than with her genius. Women have been conditioned to be body-centered, sex-centered, but for male consumption. Her body is admired, enjoyed by someone else. She is distanced from her sexuality, experiencing her body secondhand through the male's response to her. In this way, she is turned away from her own desires. As the French feminist Hélène Sioux says, we've been turned away from our bodies, shamefully taught to ignore them, to strike them with that stupid sexual modesty. We've been made victims of the old fool's game. Each will love the other sex. I'll give you your body and you'll give me mine. Few women have as yet won back their body. Hélène Sioux goes on to say, women must learn to write through their bodies. They must invent the impregnable language that will wreck partitions, classes, and rhetorics, regulations, and codes.